Good morning, Western Alaska, and welcome to The Exchange. My name is Maddie Winchester, and I'm here in the studio this morning with my co-host, Emily Russell. Today, we're talking about Medicaid reform for seniors and those living with disabilities.
Good morning, Maddie, and welcome to our guest, Dwayne Mays. Dwayne, could you just introduce yourselves to our listeners and tell us what you do for Alaska's Department of Health and Social Services?
Sure. Thank you. I want to thank you for allowing me to be on this radio station. So I was pretty happy when I got a call from you guys and you said that I'm on, so I appreciate that. My name is Dwayne Mays, and I work for the Department of Health and Social Services. I'm the director for the Division of Senior and Disability Services, and it's our long-term support services component. So it's really what we do is we support people to remain within their communities for as long as possible in their home. We provide protection for our vulnerable populations, but that's the gist of what we do, supporting people so they can remain within their homes and their communities.
All right. And Dwayne, I'm really looking forward to the conversations we're going to have with you about these new parts of Medicaid that we're looking at and what that's going to mean. But I do want to also remind our listeners that this show is for you as well. And this is an opportunity for you to call in, to participate with your ideas, with your opinions, with your questions. So we have a few things to get you thinking. Are you a senior citizen or are you someone living with a disability? Does anyone in your family or village fall into these categories? And what do you think about the current state of services offered for the elderly and those with disabilities in your community? And I want to remind our listeners that this is a complicated topic, and it's one that not everybody fully understands. And I myself am in this boat that I find Medicaid to be a complicated topic. So I'm really encouraging you to call or reach out to us online with any question you may have. You may think that it seems like a silly question, but I guarantee you someone else has that question. So this is a great time for you to get some of those questions answered as we have these conversations with Dwayne, no matter how large or small that they are.
And if you're calling from Nome, our number is 443-5221. Outside of Nome, you can call our toll-free number at 1-800-478-5666. And if you can't call in, you can reach us online at knom.org and click on the link for exchange. So, Dwayne, I wanted to start off, I know Maddie just said it's a really complicated issue, and I wanted to start off with a very basic question. Who is eligible for Medicaid, and what services are they entitled to?
Sure. A good question, and a question that I often get. Eligibility, you have to meet income eligibility, which is the first step, and that occurs through the Division of Public Assistance. So, I want to avoid getting into the complexities of what that means, mm-hmm. but low income, and to simplify it, you know, anywhere from $20,000 to $25,000 that you generate on an annual basis as an individual. So the first step is income eligibility. Mm-hmm. If you make that, the second step is that if you're unable to take care of yourself and you have multiple needs, you can't do any of your self-care. You can't keep up with your home, you know, the things that you do every day, day in and day out, making a meal, doing your laundry, cleaning up the house, and so forth. If you have multiple issues like that, you would be found eligible. And we use a term which probably wouldn't make any sense to the listener. You meet institutional level of care. Your needs are so substantial that you would probably need care in a nursing home or in an institutional hospital and so forth. So we bring supports to those individuals within their communities so that they can stay at home, bringing in self-care kinds of home care people to provide supports. That's what our program is all about.
And that seems like a really important program specifically for our region in rural Alaska, right, where there might not be a major hospital in your region or even a senior home for people. So can you explain the two programs that you're here to promote? Just sort of explain them very briefly for us.
Sure. And I'll do my best to be as succinct and to keep this simple because it is complicated. We currently have the engine to who we are in terms of our program is our home and community-based services. And we have within the federal rules. We call it the 1915C waiver. And it's a 50-50 match. So for every state dollar that we spend, we get $1 from the feds. That's a good thing. Mm-hmm. So it's a 50-50 match. And it's supporting people within their homes. So if they qualify, they meet income eligibility, and they're so disabled and their needs are so substantial that they would meet that eligibility, we use those funds to support them within their community. The challenge is the budget. And I've been going out to communities, and I'm telling everyone that we're in a fiscal crisis. So if we do nothing, we will be subject to more cuts. Mm-hmm. And we've already taken cuts. So our challenge is to make sure that we're supporting our vulnerable populations, that we're supporting our seniors, our children, people with disabilities. That's the challenge. So what we want to do, and other states have started this, is to refinance our current program and change that to look at two other options that currently exist within the federal government to draw down more federal dollars. So that match that I was telling you about for dollar for dollar, 50% state dollars, 50% federal dollars, we could actually get more dollars if we consider these two other options.
Okay.
So that's the reason why we're out meeting with the community. Looking at these options, we're required to do that from the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services. So it's getting more dollars into the state.
And what would that match look like? You know, instead of a 50-50 match, do you have any idea what those numbers would be?
Sure. Well, there's two, and again, this is complicated, but there are two options. And I mentioned to you that currently we have the 1915C waiver. The two other options that we're looking at are called 1915K and 1915I. So with a 1915K, we can get an additional 6% federal match. So it's not dollar for dollar. It's 56%. So if in our preliminary run of those numbers, that would bring in millions of dollars to the state. The other option, 1915I, we would use that to supplant our grant program. So with the I option, you don't have to meet institutional-level care eligibility. Mm-hmm. We have many grant programs that are pure general fund dollars. They're state dollars. Those are the grants that are going to be cut, have been cut, and will continue to be cut. Mm-hmm. So we want to refinance those grants to bring in additional federal dollars.
So this is an either-or situation. Is that correct? You know, we're either going to go with I or K, or we'll stay with C. Is that what's happening here?
What I would see is that we will have 1915K and we will have 1915I. And many of the services that currently are offered through C will be transferred over to K and I. With K, as I said, an additional 6% federal match. There may be some services that we will still have within the C waiver, but the majority of those services will be moved over. Our intent is that the recipient who is getting those services wouldn't know that that actually happened. Hmm. The services will remain the same. They continue to get those supports within their community. That's the goal.
Okay, great. So now that we have a little bit of background information, and I want to get into more details soon, we're going to go to our first caller. And this caller is from Nome. So welcome to The Exchange. You are live on the air. Hello, are you there?
Yes, I am.
What would you like to share with us today?
I was medevaced down to Anchorage the first... Hello?
Yes, hello, we can hear you.
Oh, okay. I was medevaced to Anchorage the end of last month and came back 4 days later. Oh.
Okay, is there anything else you'd like to share besides that medevac?
Yes, I had to pay my own way back, and I would like that money back. I had to pay our own way back, and I would like that money back.
All right, I think Dwayne is going to respond to this.
Thank you. So are you on Medicaid? So in your trip to Anchorage, was this funded by Medicaid? And you said that when you came back, you had to pay for your own way back. And so I guess my first question would be is, was this a Medicaid issue?
Yes.
Okay, so Medicaid paid for you to get to Anchorage, and what you're saying is that they didn't pay for you to get back.
Yeah, well, how could I travel when I was in surgery?
Right. That is interesting, because if they approved it for you to get there, they would also want you to get back. So I'm just not sure as to why that occurred. Usually when they approve it, it's a full trip there and back. So.
So what do you think you can do?
Well, here's what I would ask you to do. Why don't you start with me? When I get back to Anchorage, I'm going to go ahead and give you my phone number. And you can start with me, and let's see if we can get you to the right person and figure out what happened. And then I would want to ask you more questions, and I don't think we should do that on air. So my phone number in Anchorage is 269-2083. So start with that number, and then I'll help you to get you to the right source.
Okay, I got it.
All right, thank you so much to our caller in Nome for calling into The Exchange. And we are going to move things along here, continuing our conversations with Duane about Medicaid reform. And we are encouraging other callers to participate in today's show. There's a few ways you can do that. You can do it via the phone, like our caller in Nome did just now, and you can also participate online. So if you want to call us on the phone and you're inside Nome, give us a call at 443-5221. And if you're out in the villages, you can call us toll-free 1-800-478-5666.
You can also visit us online at knom.org. Click on the link to exchange, and you can leave a message online, and we'll share your thoughts on the air. And that brings us to our first comment online, and that sort of relates to our first caller, actually, sort of looking at finances and matching that, what they're eligible for in terms of support. So we've got Michael in Nome, and his comment is, because PA looks at gross Social Security, which is his only income, instead of gross minus Medicare Parts A, B, D, and Medigap, I make too much money for Medicaid. There is a Miller Trust, but I need a lawyer to work the numbers to see if it makes sense for me. Legal Aid does not have a lawyer on staff in Nome. So one visit to Anchorage to see a specialist or a Miller Trust lawyer is beyond his means. He's 77 years old and seems to be a bit in a bit of a bind, and he's looking for any help from you, Duane. So if you have any suggestions for someone in that sort of situation, what would you suggest Michael do in that situation?
Sure. First, I would ask Michael to go to our website. There is a link on our website referred to as the Aging and Disability Resource Center. We have five in the state, and so there's a list of phone numbers. So identify which one would be the most appropriate, closest to him to call. And they have what I refer to as counselors that will kind of help them to navigate the complexities of that, for example. What is it that's missing? You know, what are your challenges, and what can we do to help you get through this process to address that issue? You mentioned that you're over income, and of course there are rules, and so if you're over income, unfortunately you're not going to be eligible, because I mentioned before, income eligibility is the first step. But that's where I would start. If after all of that, and you step back and you feel that this is just not right, we have what we refer to as the Disability Law Center. And so if you feel like you need to address that and get some legal support and representation, I would contact the Disability Law Center. Now, I don't have that number in front of me, but if you're connected to the Internet, just type that in, and it's going to come up, and you'll have numbers that you can look to and make that phone call.
And to our listeners, we will make an effort to get some of these links to these websites that Dwayne is referencing up on our webpage after the show so that you'll have them in one easy-to-access location. Yeah. And Dwayne, we've talked kind of at this point sort of in generalities about Medicaid and the changes that we're looking at. And I'd like to explore something more in our region specifically. I know that in rural Alaska, care often looks pretty different than it might in Anchorage or in the lower 48. So I'm wondering if we can talk a little bit about any differences that will happen within rural Alaska specifically as a result of these changes.
We are always challenged when it comes to services in our urban communities versus services in our rural community. There is no question that there is a significant difference. And if we don't change the rules to a certain degree when it comes to providing services in rural Alaska, we're going to struggle. Workforce capacity is number one. It's our ability to find workers to support those individuals within their homes in rural communities. It's not easy. So we have, you know, it's a new day. We have a new administration. We are tasked to do what we can to really reach out to rural Alaska. Our commissioner is Val Davidson from Bethel. She's native and has been very clear with us what this administration's mission is all about. We are exploring the concept of coming up with maybe a universal worker. So it's unique in that this universal worker will do a variety of things beyond just what you might find in an urban community where you have all these different professionals that provide those support services. And then exploring the possibility of maybe a different rate for these universal workers to entice people to consider employment in rural Alaska. The key is home care, and it's trying to identify the appropriate wage, it's worth their time. They can make a living off of that. So a concept that we have been exploring is the universal worker.
And what do you think training would look like for something like that? Would people have to travel to Anchorage to receive that kind of training? Is that something that could happen in Nome or via distance? Or is it the type of thing that people could have maybe a scholarship or some sort of other financing to pay their way if they have to go to Anchorage for a period of training?
So training could happen if there's a provider organization, an operation, you know, and we have those that are national organizations that have representation here in the state. Our tribal partners are a key player. So the employer themselves would provide that training. We do some training through our division, but not to the level that one would need. Then, of course, it's the level of training. So if you're dealing with someone who's very complicated, it could be a senior with dementia, Alzheimer's disease and related dementia. That's a very challenging individual to work with. They have age. They're having cognitive deficits and struggles. So it's a different skill set. So when we talk about training, if you think about the landscape of all the different possible disabilities, what is the skill set that we're looking for? So we've been working to address that as well.
Is there a program similar to that, you know, with universal workers in other states that's being used right now?
I don't believe so. This is a concept that was brought up in our partnership with the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, the Elders Committee. It's a subset, and it's about long-term care. And so in our interactions with that group, we actually came up with the concept of the universal worker. So we're going to move forward and explore it some more and see if we can make it happen, understanding that finances right now is challenging for us because of the fiscal crisis.
Yeah, I'm curious. I know Governor Bill Walker just released his budget for this year. And how has your department been affected by this fiscal crisis? And were there funds set aside in this budget to say expand these programs in the last week?
So as a director, you know, as you might imagine, when that came out, I definitely wanted to know what that looked like in particular for the Division of Senior and Disability Services. I'm very pleased. I didn't see any reductions in our grant components. So when you think about some of our basic grant services to support seniors within their community, no reductions there. There have been cuts in the past, but I think we're at a point now where we're pretty lean and mean. And so across the board, no cuts in our grant components. Our administrative budget did not take a hit, so we're happy about that because you got to have the workforce to be able to do the work. We did take a reduction in our Medicaid component of about $9 million, so that's there. I appreciate the governor and the fact that I think we have reached a point in time where we can't balance the budget on just continuing to cut state government.
Right.
And for our division, I think we're at a point where if we do more, we may suffer the consequences of that. I use the analogy of one more step and then we're in a free fall. And so we have to be very careful. And I think he truly does understand that as a governor. And it's time for us to be looking at other ways to generate revenue for the state.
And that's largely what this switch is about.
Yes, exactly. You're spot on. It's looking at refinancing our existing program, bringing in additional federal dollars. So absolutely true.
And Dwayne, you mentioned that you're here to get input from people who work with the elderly and those with disabilities, and also from, you know, people who may be in that situation themselves or have a family member in that situation. I know you had, I think, two meetings here in Nome yesterday. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Could you go over kind of a recap of what the purpose of those meetings was? Maybe any interesting questions, concerns, ideas that came out of that interaction that you had with the public?
Sure. So yesterday afternoon, we started, we had a three-hour meeting, and we met with the providers that actually provide those services, which is always a very, in my mind, that's an important meeting because you want to hear from the providers that do the work. And what we did is we presented, it was about 45 minutes to start, where we had the floor, and we gave a presentation on what does 1915I and K mean. So drilling down on those two options that are available through the Social Security Act. And then also, I feel like I need to let them know that we're doing this because of our fiscal crisis. So what does that mean? So kind of laying out that foundation. It's a new day. You know, we have to do something. We can't just sit back and react to cuts. We have to do something. So we laid that all out. And then we ended with about an hour to hour and a half of discussion. And so we allow people to ask us questions, providers. Some of the common themes, and one we just talked about, is the workforce issue. The other, and being very transparent, you know, we have assessment tools that we use to determine eligibility. And providers and some families don't like those tools. So one of the deliverables that we're going to move forward with is looking at other assessment tools that exist in the lower 48. We'll explore that and see if we can come up with better tools, assessment tools. So workforce capacity, assessments tools, making sure that we honor a senior's right to remain within their rural community instead of coming to an urban community. And I understand that and I support that. Those were some of the common themes.
And were those conversations in the providers meeting similar to the meeting you had later on with the general public?
Yes, that's fair to say. We also had a very good turnout. We met last night at the old St. Joe's Church, I think is the name. Beautiful, by the way. Mm-hmm. We were really impressed with that. Lovely Christmas tree in the background. and really good attendance and really appropriate questions, similar to what I just talked about. Workforce, the assessment tools. I think there is some anxiety from families. So they see this and they worry. What does this mean? Are you doing this because of cuts? Well, we're doing it because of future probable cuts, but to refinance so that we can stretch our dollars to serve more people, the people that we currently are serving and more people going forward. And the thing that I've always said, which is really important, is that what do you want for quality of life? What's important to you in terms of quality of life? Our children are important to me. Our seniors are important to me. People with disabilities, that's important. So how far do we go before we lose that quality of life in Alaska? So I've been very clear in these communities that I, as an Alaskan, want that quality of life.
And you mentioned that people, there's a concern, they're wondering, like, what does this mean for me, for my relative? And this is a really abstract topic, and it's something that's kind of hard to wrap your head around. So, I mean, can we think of maybe just like a hypothetical person who is living in a rural village receiving care? I think you mentioned earlier that the goal is for them not to even notice a change. Could you elaborate on that more?
Sure. So let's go with a senior who is in his late 80s, has lived a good life, but is starting to fail. And when I talk about self-care, it's one's ability to bathe themselves, or it may be, you know, just cooking a meal or keeping up with their home. So we identify what that laundry list of challenges are, and then we bring somebody in who provides, they're considered a home care attendant. They come in and they will do all of those things. They will maybe help the senior to get out of bed. They may struggle to just get up and down from bed, to walk across the where they live from one location to another. They may need some type of support so they can ambulate across the floor. All those things in the senior world, we have a personal care attendant program, and that's what that's all about. It's just supporting seniors so they can live within their home. So that's a real common type of scenario.
And the goal is for that to not look any different with, like, exactly, on that end with these changes. Yeah. So really the difference would be on the financial end.
Exactly. The piece to know is that those costs, so when you think about that type of support, the average cost is anywhere from $20,000 to $25,000 a year for a senior to get that kind of support. Mm-hmm. Now, one might think that that's pretty expensive. It's really not. But if that senior is in a nursing home, then we're looking at costs up to $200,000 or $300,000. Our goal is to minimize the high-end costs by stretching their time, extending their time within their home. So those natural the supports that we can provide, maybe another 5-10 years in home before they ultimately have to maybe end up in a nursing home or assisted living home. So that's our goal. It's financially prudent as a state.
All right, and I think we're going to go to our next caller here. We're going to hear from Roger in White Mountain. Roger, you're live on the air. Welcome to The Exchange. Roger, are you there?
Yeah, good morning.
Good morning. What would you like to share with us today?
Well, happy holidays. Well, anyway, Medicaid and Medicare and IHS, are they different entities or do they collaborate with each other? I'll hang up and listen to your response. Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year to everybody. Thank you.
All right. Merry Christmas to you too, Roger. Thanks for calling. A question for Dwayne to address here about a few different entities.
Sure. Merry Christmas to you. So we do partner. So when we talk about Indian Health Services, IAHS, we do work with our tribal partners front and center. So that's important, and we do that. They are really separate entities. So Medicaid and Medicare within the state system is a little... Although it's the same in terms of what we're trying to accomplish, it's really two different funding streams. So for IHS, it would be our native communities. They can draw down those dollars, which is 100%. So that's a good thing. It's 100% of federal dollars. Within our division, we do have Medicare. And I know that when talking with our staff, they do work closely with our tribal entities, our tribal partners. So there's a strong collaboration. That's our task under this administration. We have a commissioner that demands that, and we honor it.
All right. So an answer there to Roger in White Mountain's question. And if you are listening and you have a question, you too can call into the show at 443-5221 if you're listening in Nome. And if you're listening from outside of Nome, call us toll-free at 1-800-478-5666.
And you can also visit us online if you can't call in at knom.org and click on the link for exchange, and you can leave a message with us online and we'll share your thoughts on the air. And so, Dwayne, I want to talk about, you said you mentioned you were in Barrow before this, and I'm assuming you've done a lot of travel throughout the state. And I know rural Alaska is very unique, but do you see some common challenges existing in, say, Barrow, but also in the Kenai and just sort of throughout the state? What are the most common challenges in the search for the best Medicaid option in this program?
Well, as I mentioned, it looks much different when you are in Kenai. We were down in Kenai. I think the biggest concern that families have is that their son or daughter that's receiving services or a senior that's receiving services would change, that they would receive less. And so I provided assurances that we want to be very transparent and very seamless in moving from one program to another. Obviously, in those communities, there are a lot more supports. You know, there are more providers. And so the challenge, though, is that we don't have that in, we have very little of that in rural Alaska. So I think the key to our success is to elevate our partnership with our tribal programs. Mm-hmm. The sophistication of what you have here, the Norton Sound Health Corporation, we just toured that facility. We met with staff yesterday. I was over there this morning, very impressed. So we really need to have stronger relationship with our tribal partners. I think the thing that really stands out for me that we've been pushing is the use of telecommunication, telehealth. Our nurses, we have assessors that go out to rural Alaska to do these assessments. We're required to reassess every year. We're very challenged to get to rural Alaska because of the weather, the cancellations, the delays, and so forth. And that's been going on for way too long. So I believe one option is to use telehealth, connecting to village health clinics to be able to do some of our reassessments for those individuals that are on our program. We've implemented that. We got support from the department, from the Alaska Mental Health Trust, and we're moving forward with that. So using technology as a way to address needs in rural Alaska is huge.
And where does that funding come from? I would assume that would be quite an expensive endeavor to sort of hook up all of the village clinics to a telecommunication device.
We have agreements that we're working on putting in place one at a time, going from one tribal organization to another. So that's the first step. And then it's reaching out to their lead IT, their tech person, their tech director, to have an agreement with him so that he can send a message to these village health clinics that this is something we're going to do and working with the state. So we start at the top and we work our way down, because if we just make contact with the clinic without going through that process, then we're not going to be successful. So we have formalized agreements in place with a handful of tribal entities, tribal programs, to move forward with that. We've actually have saved costs. So we have video conferencing equipment in all of our state senior and disability service offices. Mm-hmm. We have locations throughout the state. So we have that equipment now. And the village health clinics are equipped with that equipment. So it's there. It's just a matter of making sure people know how to operate that equipment and that we're applying it, and we're following a very formalized process. So it's working, but we need to expand that to use that as another vehicle in terms of communication with rural Alaska.
Mm-hmm. I want to kind of get back to the switch that we've been talking about that you're looking at making here in the Medicaid reform. And when we spoke on the phone, you mentioned that there's a possibility that this could open up coverage for more people. And I was wondering if you could elaborate on that. I think maybe traumatic brain injuries were mentioned, so I'm looking for a little bit more information.
It's a very good question. Thanks for bringing it up, because if we hadn't answered that during this 1 hour, then I would feel that we missed the boat. So that's a good question. 1915K, when I brought that up before, we don't have to target specific populations under that particular option. If you meet financial eligibility, and if you meet eligibility for the program in terms of services, you're in. So there are no, it's for anyone and everyone. So we don't have to target. But with the 1915I, we are targeting four specific populations that we currently serve through our general fund programs, our general fund grant programs. So those four would be ADRD, Alzheimer's disease and related dementia. We are the fastest aging state in the country. Fastest aging state in the country. So that population is, quite frankly, exploding. So the percent of those with dementia is increasing dramatically. So we need to address that workforce. We are addressing it, but quite frankly, I think we need to do more. So our ADRD population, our dementia population, number one, front and center for me. Number two is our traumatic brain injury. So think about who we are as a state, our rural nature, our environment. When I look around and I see people operating four-wheelers and snow machines, they're not wearing helmets. So we have a higher incidence of traumatic brain injury. We have some funding for that. But if we could replace our general fund program dollars that could be subjected to cuts and use the 1915i option, I think that's a win-win situation. The third would be those with severe mental illness. This work that we're doing also includes behavioral health. And so we have a significant SMI population, those with severe mental illness. And currently, behavioral health and senior disability services serves them through general grant fund programs. So if we can use the I option to replace them, I think we will do a good job. The last targeted group is those with developmental disabilities. They may not meet eligibility for K because their needs are not that substantial, but they need some services. And currently, we serve them through a grant program, and it's about $13 million a year. Pure state dollars, and we could use the I option to replace that and draw down 50% federal dollars. Those are the four targeted areas that we're focusing on, is to refinance our general fund grant programs under the I option to cover those four targeted areas.
And while we're speaking really specifically here about targeted areas, I was reading yesterday a little bit of research on the Medicaid website. I read the pages that they offer on parts C, I, and K, and I did notice a difference that I think may be important to those in rural Alaska. And it's a little bit specific, a little bit technical, but I think it's important, so I'm going to try and take us through it anyway. One of the options in C, there's a section that says states can essentially like decide to opt out of like certain of following certain requirements, and one of them was statewideness, which said it lets states target waivers to areas of the state where the need is greatest or where certain types of providers are available. And for options I and K, I did not see that option to target towards certain areas, and I was wondering what the implications of that are for rural Alaska.
So I'll respond in a simple way in that the C waiver is statewide. So we have four targeted areas, but it is statewide. It's those with developmental disabilities. That's one of the four waivers. We have children with complex medical conditions. That's the other waiver. Our third waiver we refer to as Alaskans living independently. It's our senior population and people with physical disabilities. That's our third waiver. And then the fourth is adults with physical and developmental disabilities. Those are the four waivers that have been approved by the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, but it's statewide. Because the question came up in some of the forums is that, are you just targeting certain areas of the state and not others? It's statewide. Under the K option, we have to be statewide. The language is very clear in the Social Security Act that this will be a program that is statewide. And under the I option with those four targeted areas I just mentioned, ADRD, SMI, IDD, those are also statewide. So anybody that has Alzheimer's disease related dementia in this state would be, if they meet eligibility, eligible for services through the I option. So hopefully that answers your question.
Okay, yeah, great. Yeah. Thank you.
And I want to sort of get back to the local concerns and questions that were brought up to you while you were here in Nome. I know one of the leading concerns that this new program or the refinancing of the program is looking to target or allow people to stay in their communities. And I think that's, I mean, especially important in rural Alaska. I'm really curious as to what it was like before this. So if you needed care, were you just sort of on your own, or were you, you know, sent down to Anchorage for care if you were a senior and you couldn't really remain safely in your home? What did it look like before this program?
Well, let me start by saying that there are some national organizations that actually have developed scorecards, if you will, to kind of identify among the 50 states, where do you rank when it comes to long-term support services? In Alaska, I'm proud to say, has been ranked within the top five. They have like five indicators that they look at, and I don't want to go through those, but one being quality of life. So when you think about what are the package of services that we offer, I'm pretty proud of that. And I talk to my counterparts in other states, and they're always giving me a hard time that, you know, you always rank at the very top in terms of just quality of life for long-term support services. So I want to put that out there. That's important. We have had 30 years of the Home and Community-Based Services C waiver. It's been great. If you talk to the organizations, the advocacy organizations, they would probably say that it's been great. Alaska has always been leading the edge in terms of quality of life for our senior population, people with disabilities. I see that remaining under the I and K option. I don't see that changing at all. We do a pretty good job. We can do better in rural Alaska. I think that's the big one for me. We can do better relying on family members in terms of providing supports. So if it's your mother or father, would we allow a son or a daughter to provide supports to that family? We do that. We have to be creative and innovative. So going into those respective rural communities, villages, it's who can we rely on within the villages to provide those supports. So I think as a general rule, we have done fairly well, but we can do better.
And how would you find those people? I mean, are you or people in your department, are they going out to villages? Are they making those trips and meeting people at the village clinic and family members and things like that? How does that connection happen?
Our involvement would be to meet with the families when it comes to assessing where they're at in terms of need. That's our job. We have nurse assessors that travel to rural Alaska, anywhere in the state, to do that. And then we're required to do one every year. It's a mandate from the federal government that we have to assess every year. There is a laundry list of all of these provider organizations. So we have a list of hundreds and hundreds of provider organizations that provide those kind of supports. It's a pretty robust industry. I could rattle off a ton of those, but then that would be inappropriate on air. I would have a provider saying, why didn't you mention our organization? But I can assure you there are some providers that work in urban and rural areas. So we have a laundry list.
And as we get into the last 15 minutes of our show, if you're listening and you have a question, a concern, an opinion, it's getting down to the wire of when you can call those in. So we have 15 minutes left. I really encourage you to find a way to participate, to get those questions answered, those concerns voiced. And there are a number of ways you can participate. You can call us or you can go online. And if you were to do that, you would go to our website, knom.org, and click on the exchange link that's at the top of the main page. And calling us is also an option.
If you're calling from Nome, our number is 443-5221. Outside of our number, you can call toll-free, outside of Nome, you can call our toll-free number at 1-800-478-5666.
And Dwayne, what does the next step look like? You've been traveling around, you've been getting input from providers, from receivers, and I'm curious kind of when is the decision going to be made and what else is involved in this process?
Good question. So I didn't mention this in the beginning, but we signed a contract with a national entity called Health Management Associates. They have a long-term service support component to their operation. So we have them on contract working with us. The life of the contract will go to the end of July of 2016. There's a set of deliverables that need to occur by the contractor working with us. So the contractor actually is here in Nome right now. She's over at Norton Sound Health Corporation with a few other folks. So we'll be working together to do outreach. As a part of the 1915K option, we needed to create a council. And so we put that together, and we have 11 voting members. The council will be there for the life of the contract until we come up with what I refer to as the implementation plan. So at the very end of this, understand that when we complete it, we have a plan in front of us, it has to be budget neutral and or show cost savings. If we do this and it shows an increase in the budget, then it's dead on arrival. It's not going to work. So we're tasked to do that given our fiscal crisis. So we will have an implementation plan in place by the end of July of 2016, and then we have about a year to work internally on some of the regulatory work that we have to do, getting approvals from the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services. That's a mandatory requirement. So our targeted date to go live with these new options would be July 1 of 2017. Very aggressive timeline. But what I've been telling the community is that there's a sense of urgency, and so we do not want to be casual about this. We need to be very aggressive, careful, and methodical, but aggressive to get this done.
And that's the council's ultimate decision.
Yeah, the council will work with the state. So as we start to kind of put this together and design what I and K will look like, you know, in terms of the service package and what have you, we're interacting with the council to get their advice. The 11 voting members are those that are actually families or recipients that are receiving services. So we have seniors that are on that council. We have parents that have children or adults with developmental disabilities. We have those that have experienced traumatic brain injury, and then we have survivors of SMI. So that's our severe mental illness. That's our council. So it's an ongoing interactive dialogue with them on a monthly basis. Now remember, they're advising us. They don't make the decisions. The state ultimately has the authority to make the decision on what this is going to look like.
And is that council made up of people from all over the state?
Yes. And there have been lots of questions. And, you know, I have been challenged by some communities in that you haven't done enough to have a rural representation. But I stand by it. I believe that I have done that. We have representation, an elder from Kotzebue who is on the council. We have a individual from Barrow that's on the council. We have people from Southeast. So when you look at the landscape of those voting members, I think we have done a good job of getting that rural representation. The Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium is there with us in an advisory capacity as any other association to help us in the formation of this new design.
And if people are listening, maybe they're a provider, maybe they are somebody who receives care or has a family member who receives care, and they were not able to make it to one of these meetings to ask questions, voice opinions, is there a way that they can still do that?
Yes. So we have a few more live stakeholder engagement events, another week of that in first week of January. And then mid-January, we're going to do a webinar and do a statewide webinar to reach out to others that may have not been involved in any of those stakeholder engagement meetings. I should mention that we have a link on our website referred to as Community First Choice, and that's that 1915K option I was talking about. So all of our what's happening today, the provider meeting yesterday, the community event last night, all of that goes onto our website in terms of notes. So anything you want to know about this, what does it mean in terms of I and K, is on our website on that. If you click that link, you go right to all those documents. So,
And I want to just take a step back before the show wraps up and think about those that have not yet started receiving benefits under Medicaid. if you think you may be eligible, what steps can someone take, say, in Nome to seek out those benefits?
I mentioned back in the beginning that in terms of knowing what the landscape looks like, how to navigate different application processes and so forth, if you start with the Aging and Disability Resource Center, and or you could call our Division of Senior Disability Services. If you call the front desk, they'll be able to navigate you to the right person.
And you mentioned that there was a counselor in Nome, is that right?
No, we don't have any staff here in Nome that work for the division, but there are providers. So if you, and that, there you go. That's another thing I should probably mention. we have provider organizations here in Nome as well. And again, I can't mention them, but you should be able to reach out to them, and they have the ability to help you navigate the system.
Okay, great. Are there any questions that we have not asked that you think should be mentioned on air before the show closes up?
I don't think so. I think this has been a good interview, and just thank you. I feel like we've covered everything. It's been very thorough. I think you guys probably pick up this is important to us. Mm-hmm. It's important to me, and I think my parents would be proud of me if they knew what I was doing today. So.
And I want to remind our listeners that we are going to do our best to get some of these links up on our webpage that Dwayne has mentioned in our interview to get them all in one place for anybody who needs a little bit more information or has specific questions that can't be answered via the internet. And as we wrap up our show, just kind of thinking about some last minute questions, some closing remarks. We have time for maybe just one more caller if anybody is sitting on a question that they want answered. You can give us a quick call at 443-5221 or 1-800-478-5666 and ask your question or give your comment. Or if not, Dwayne mentioned some other resources for giving feedback that are going to be available pretty soon. So, Dwayne, I think we are going to do some closing statements. So maybe if you could sort of take a step back to the generalities. Maybe somebody just tuned in 10 minutes ago. Could we sort of do a re-overview of what we've talked about, why you're here?
You bet. So the Division of Senior Disability Services wants to refinance our existing system so that we can draw down more federal dollars so that we can continue to provide long-term support services for our senior population, people with disabilities, within their community, within their homes. To avoid at all costs the higher end of costs. And from my perspective, it's much more dignified. I like to think that I would be able to age well and age in my home in place going forward. So that's what we're doing is refinancing to draw down more federal dollars.
And can we re-go over the fact that the individual level of care, we're expecting to see not any changes on that.
Absolutely. So the requirements to meet eligibility for the C waiver are no different than what we believe will be in the requirements for the K option going forward. The K option will give us additional federal dollars. The I option will have a different eligibility for those are individuals that don't meet the eligibility, but they need some support. So we can define what that eligibility will be for the I option.
And we talked a little bit earlier about some possibilities for expanding coverage, you know, to individuals who may be suffering from a traumatic brain injury and similar things. And would this coverage be beginning in July 1st of 2017 if we make this switch, or would that happen earlier?
It would be July of 2017. So if we can aggressively move through this and make sure that we hit all the benchmarks that we're required to hit, we would go live with the system in July of 2017. So new to our world would be the I option in particular. K and C are similar in terms of what they do.
Emily, do you have any final questions or comments?
Yeah, if you could, I know it's such a complicated issue.
Yes,
if you could just briefly again do like a two-minute explanation of those two different I and K options and how they differ from C. Just, you know, just a brief rundown, again, a reminder to our listeners how those options are different.
Sure. So for the 1915C waiver, eligibility is that you need to meet a very high level of need. We refer to it as institutional level of care. That's identical to the K option, no different in terms of eligibility requirements. So the menu of services that currently exists in terms of supporting people within their communities under the C waiver would be almost identical to the K option. Our intent would be to transition the majority of those that are receiving services through the C waiver over the K option so we can get more dollars coming in at the federal level. It's a 6% enhanced rate. We currently have a 50-50 rate, dollar for dollar, in terms of federal match. So it's an enhancement. The I option would allow us to look at our existing general fund grant programs and those four targeted areas that I mentioned. Those particular disabilities, our aging and our dementia population, those with developmental disabilities. We have those that don't meet eligibility under the K option or C waiver that continue to get services through the I option under our grant programs. We would supplant those grant programs with our I option going forward.
Okay, great. Thanks so much.
Yeah, it's complicated. Yeah.
Would the difference in federal funding change the out-of-pocket cost for the average person, or is it really just about like the state funding versus federal funding?
State and federal. So it doesn't really impact the individual if they meet financial eligibility.
So. All right. Well, we are officially wrapping up our show here. So now is the time to say thank you to everyone who's listening. A special thank you to our callers. We had a caller from Nome, and we heard from Roger in White Mountain. And we also had an online comment as well from Michael in Nome. So thank you to everyone who participated. And thank you so much to my co-host, Emily Russell, for being here in the studio today.
Thanks for being a great host, Maddie. And thanks to Duane Mays, who joined us this morning. Sorry about that. And thanks for coming up to Nome and speaking with our community. It's really special that you're here, and I'm sure everyone appreciates it.
Thank you.
And this is our last episode of The Exchange for this season. So tune in January for brand new episodes. Have a great day.